Hi, you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for September 20th. I'm Geoffrey Murphy from Drake University, your host. Here's our first story. In other news, only murderers in the building, a good time with old comedy friends. Steve Martin and Martin Short are comedy royalty comedy icons since co-starring in one of my guilty pleasures, Three Amigos, in 1986. I can even sing along with My Little Buttercup. Their acting paths have crossed several times, including the Father of the Bride movies, and more recently in their 2018 Netflix special, Steve Martin and Martin Short, An Evening You Will Forget for the Rest of Your Life. The actors slash comedians slash writers have exceptional rapport, so it was probably only natural for them to decide to join forces against for Hulu's TV series, Only Murderers in the Building. In this mystery slash comedy endeavor, Martin Short are joined by singer slash actress Selena Gomez. Martin plays Charles Hayden Savage, a silver-haired actor known mostly for his one role as a TV sleuth in the 1980s. Short plays Oliver Putnam, a mostly failing theater producer, who is one of the verge of being evicted. And Gomez plays Mabel Morrow, a woman from the wrong side of the tracks who is squatting in their upscale New York apartment building in the fictional Laconia. All come together when a rather unlikable tenant, Tim Kono, is, you guessed it, murdered during the fire drill. While trying to figure out who committed the murder and why the two celebrities has been collaborating on a podcast based in their investigation. It's a way to jumpstart their careers, and Putnam hopes it will raise much-needed funds. Murder mystery podcasts are incredibly popular, after all. The series premiered August 31st, and I'll be honest, initially, I was skeptical. I saw the press photo, poster, and wondered what those two septuagenarians were doing, running around almost 30 years old. If it was a love story, I would give a hard pass. No one needs another project about old men and young love interest. No. No one. But I do like both Martin and Martin Short, so I watched the trailer. It seemed promising. Hulu was smart in that they released the first three episodes for immediate screening. For the rest, you must wait for the new episodes to drop on Tuesdays. I watched them one after another and got immediately hooked. It's a very entertaining series. Their writing is sharp and funny. Martin and Martin Short are a joy to watch, playing so naturally off one another. Martin is the reserved straight guy. He's always kind of over it. And Short is the flamboyant, effusive, always trying to get an ill-conceived project off the ground type. Their personalities couldn't be more deficient. Their personalities couldn't be more different, and watching them react to one another is never dull. In fact, it's enjoyable watching them that Gomez doesn't really need to be here. She gets cast regularly as an actress, and I don't get her appeal. As a singer, she's very good. As an actress, yeah, no. No doubt, she was brought in to bring in younger viewers, thus giving the show broader appeal. If you're older than 40, you will enjoy the celebrity cameos, including so far Sting, Nathan Lane, Amy Ryan, and Tina Fey. If you are older than 40, you will enjoy watching the celebrities cameos, including so far Sting, Nathan Lane, Amy Ryan, and Tina Fey. In other news, Muhammad Ali was really sweet and cuddly, daughter just said. Ding, ding, ding. In the boxing ring, Muhammad Ali may have been a driven competitor, determined to win no matter what. At home, however, he was sweet and cuddly, according to Dr. Rashid Ali. I think a lot of that had to do with my grandmother, Mama Bird, and who was the greatest person you want to meet. There wasn't a mean bone in her body. You can't take that sweet man out of the boxer. In the Ken Burns documentary, Muhammad Ali, viewers get to see another side to the man who could float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. Daddy was a gentle giant, for sure.
He loved us to play games with him and read the Quran to him. And he did shed a tear at home when we would read something that would really personate with him. Still, the boxer, formerly known as Cassius Clay, had the side that detested his reputation as the greatest. He refused to be drafted to the army and was stripped of his title. He couldn't box for more than 3 years, was found guilty for dodging the draft, and became the subject of a Supreme Court case that said an appeal brought did not give a reason for denying him conspicuous objector status. The attention gave him the identity beyond sports. Closer to home, family members were rocked by his infidelities, marriages, and out of the wedlock children. There were a lot of people around my father that weren't good for him, Marisha said. Daddy was a good spirited person, but he made mistakes and he always owned up to them. Naturally, we were more forgiving and we kind of understood the circumstances that my dad was under were unique in nature. In the limited PBS series, Burns shows the boxer through the ups and downs of his life and career. Michael Bennett, a former heavyweight champion, says Ali, was surrounded by people who live off other people. They kept him boxing because they wanted to make money off him. Rishi Ali says her father probably would have boxed long after he did if he hadn't been diagnosed with Parkinson's. He loved it so much, my dad couldn't say goodbye to boxing. Boxing had to say goodbye to him. Like Bennett, she believes his supporters wanted him to continue because he was basically their ATM. Because he started at such an early age, he was boxing at 12. Ali had the ability to play with the sports conventions. What Muhammad Ali did in the ring, you can't teach, Ben says. You were not taught to drop your hands and lean back. He crafted his own style. Ali also used lessons he learned from his friendships with Malcolm X, Ben adds, his expressed that in physical ways. Burns Ali said, Ali used lessons he learned from his friendship with Malcolm X, Ben adds, he expressed that in physical way. Burns says Ali had a confidence that served him in and out of the ring. He was always aware that he was guided by something bigger than himself, and that permitted him a kind of exaltation of the norms. In other news, starting young students are right in astronomy. A good friend of mine has a young daughter who has developed an apparent fascination with the stars. That is a good thing. Some of the questions, however, have stumped him. That isn't a good thing. I explained to the father that astronomy is a learning experience, and the best thing he could do to satisfy his daughter's inquisition. Was to take her to a public library. As I've mentioned in many of my columns in the past, there are a multitude of beginner books and other materials at the library that are all written and designated especially for the young of age, as well as sometimes overwhelmed parents. By combining through the astronomy show, you should be able to find topics that interest the child and then follow it up on further books. As Alan McRobert wrote in Sky and Telescope magazine, many newcomers to stargazing blunder down the wrong trail that too often leaves them lost and frustrated. It's too bad that there isn't a way to post a couple well-chosen directives. At the beginning of that trail. In addition to the books, another way to stimulate a child's learning experience in stargazing is to take them to the another way to stimulate a child's learning experience in stargazing is to take them to the Contosine planet. In addition to the books, another way to stimulate a child's learning experience in the stargazing is to take them to the Contosine Planetarium on the campus of the University of Nebraska at Omaha. To find out which programs are being offered at the planetarium, call them at 402-554-3722. That's 402-554-3722. I think parents will enjoy the experience as much as the child. Astronomy is an outdoor nature hobby. Living in the metropolitan area with its abundant skyline, we are limited to as many. Living in the metropolitan area with its abundant skylight, we are limited as to the number of stars visible to us. I would suggest a trip outside the city lights to give a new stargazer the chance to view the constellations they have been told about, read about, or even seen in pictures. When the father brought up the subject of telescopes, I explained to him that too many times parents spend a lot of money for a telescope only to have a child lose interest when it does not perform the way they expect it to. Very young children are unable to understand cause and effect or to rationalize what it is you are trying to explain to them. That is especially true with the telescope. I told the father that he should explain to his daughter that the hobby of astronomy can be a source of enjoyment her entire life. I also mentioned that the most successful stargazers are often the ones who began with the less equipment. What they lacked in gear, they had to make up by study, sky knowledge, and maps. By fine-tuning their observing eyes first, those skills will come in very handy when the gear does come. A good proportion of stargazing activities will be disrupted. A good portion of stargazing activities will be disrupted by the moonlight as the moon approaches its full phase Monday. A good portion of stargazing activities will be disrupted by the moonlight as the moon approaches its full phase Monday. We should all get prepared for the beginning of autumn in the Midwest at 2:21 p.m. on Wednesday. George Wein, Newport Jazz Festival co-founder, dies at 95. New York. George Wein, an impresario of the 20th century music who helped found the newspaper New York. George Wein, an impresario of the 20th century music who helped found the Newport Jazz and folk festivals and set the template for the gatherings everywhere, from Woodstock to the south of France, died Monday. Wein, 95, dies peacefully in his sleep in his New York City apartment, said Caroline McClare, a family spokesperson. A former jazz club owner and aspiring pianist, Wein launched the Newport Jazz Festival in 1954 under pouring rain with a lineup for the heavens. Billie Holiday and Dizzy Giles Pye, Ella Fitzgerald and Lester Young, Louis Armstrong was there the following year, and Duke Ellington made history in 1956. His band set featuring an extraordinary 27-chorus solo from saxophonist Paul Gallaudet that almost single-handedly received the middle-aged Ellington's career. Wein led the festival for more than 50 years, and performers would include virtually every major jazz star from Miles Davis and Thelonious Monk to Charles Mingus and Wynton Marsalis. Just in 1965, the bill featured Frank Sinatra, Count Basie, John Coltrane, Ellington Gisali, Davis, and Monk. As a young pianist and club owner, he understood quality, worshipped the givens of music, and created a venture. He understood quality worship, the giants of the music, and created a revolutionary festival format that offered the widest possible range of jazz to much larger outdoor audiences. Morales has said in a statement, he loved telling stories about Bird, Duke, and all the greats, engaged in spirited debates on a variety of subjects, and was an optimistic supporter of young talent. The success of Newport inspired a wave of jazz festivals in the U.S., and the Wein created his... His other projects, including the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival and the Grand Parade du Jazz in Nice, France. His multi-day all-star gatherings were also a model for rock festivals, whether Woodstock in 1969 or the Lollapalooza tours of recent years. Critic Gene Sinatra observed in 2003, without Wein, everything from Woodstock to jazz at Lincoln Center might have happened differently if it happened at all. Wein can justifiably claim to have invented, developed, and codified the contemporary popular music festival, Sinatra wrote. The idea for Newport came in part from locals Louis, Elaine, Laura, who urged Wein to organize a jazz festival in their gated resort community in Rhode Island. Elaine Lorraine, isolated, complained that the summer scene was terribly boring. Her tobacco heir husband backed her up with $20,000 donation. Wein had never known of a large-scale jazz festival, so in the spirit of the music he improvised, seeking to combine the energy and music classically of Harlem jazz club with the ambience of a summer classical concert in Tanglewood. What was the festival to me? Wein might have said. I had no rule book to go by. I knew it had to be something unique that no jazz fan had ever exposed to. Wein didn't only work with jazz musicians. In 1959, he and Pete Seeger began a companion folk festival that would feature early performances by Joan Baez and Jose Feliciano.
among others, and track the evolution of Bob Dylan from Ernest Trouble to it. Wine didn't only work with jazz musicians. In 1959, he and Pete Seeger began a companion folk festival that would feature early performances by Joan Baez and Jose Feliciano, among others, and track the evolution of Bob Dylan from Ernest Troubadour to rule-breaking rock star. Dylan's show in 1963 helped establish him as the so-called voice of his generation, but by 1965 he felt confined by the folk community and turned up to Newport with an electric band. The response was mostly positive, but there were enough boos from the crowd and conflicts backstage. Wine rejected the legend that Seeger tried to cut the power cables to Dylan's amps to make Dylan's appearance a landmark in rock and folk history. In his memoir, Myself, Among Others, Wine remembered confronting Dylan as he left the stage and demanding the return to play something acoustic. When Dylan resisted, saying he didn't have an acoustic guitar, Wine asked the volunteers to lend him one and help persuade Dylan to go back out. Years later, Wine remained moved by memories of hearing Dylan sing "It's All Over Now, Baby Blue," a farewell home ballad in more ways than one. It was a farewell to the idealism and purity of the folk revival. Wine wrote, "There was no turning back, not for Dylan, not for anyone. The Newport festivals have led to numerous films and concert albums." Notably Murray Leonard's Oscar-nominated 1967 documentary Festivals with Dylan, Johnny Cash, and Howlin' Wolf among the performers. Wine would later bring in Led Zeppelin, Sly and the Family Stone, and James Brown and other rock and rhythm blues acts. In 2020, when Newport went virtual because of the pandemic, Wine introduced Mavis Staples from his home in Manhattan. Wine himself had been a pianist since childhood, and he maintained an acoustic music. Wine himself had been a pianist since childhood, and he maintained an active music career, releasing Wine and Woman and Song, Sewing, that music, and several other albums, and making yearly appearances at the Newport Festival with the Newport All-Stars Band. He even named a jazz master in 2005 by National Endowment. He was named a jazz master in 2005 by the National He was named a jazz master in 2005 by the National Endowment for the Arts and received an honorary Grammy in 2014. Years earlier, President Clinton brought his saxophone to the White House stage for a celebration of the Newport Jazz Festival. Nan Wooden, daughter of UCLA coach Wooden. Nan Wooden, daughter of UCLA coach John Wooden, dies at 87. Los Angeles. Nan Wooden, the daughter of the late UCLA basketball coach John Wooden, had a fixture at the Brewers. Died Tuesday. She was 87. The school said she died of natural causes at a care facility in San Fernando Valley. According to family members, she had suffered a series of strokes in recent years. Wooden continued to attend UCLA games long after her Hall of Fame father retired from coaching in 1975, when the Bruins won their 10th NCAA championship. She often sat in her father's reserved seat at Paul Reed Pavilion, which served as a gathering point for extended family and friends. The court there is named for her parents. She was a frequent companion of her father in her later years at UCLA games, looking after him as he was besieged by fans for autographs and photos. John Wooden died in 2010 at the age of 99.
Nan Wooden was on hand for the unveiling of an 8-foot bronze statue of her father outside Pauley Pavilion. The sculptor had consulted with her and her family members. "I just wanted people to look at him and be able to say that John Wooden." "That's John Wooden," she said. "I don't think there's any doubt. Born Nancy Ann Wooden in 1934 in Kentucky, she was raised in her father's home, state of Indiana. The family moved to Southern California in 1948 when her father took the UCLA job. She is survived by her youngest brother, Jim, and daughters, Kathleen Trepanny, Christy Implement, and Karen Bernstein, as well as six grandchildren and four great-grandchildren. She was perceived in death by her husband, Richard Muhalson, and her mother, Nell. Nan was always so kind and exceeding to me, UCLA women's basketball coach Corey Close tweeted. She was also a spitfire, just like her mom. So sad she is gone. One of her grandsons, Tyler Trepanny, played for the Bruins from 2008 to 2012 and scored the final basket in a win against Arizona in the last game before Pauley Pavilion underwent a major renovation in 2011. Blind eye to abuse. Washington. Olympic gold medalist Simone Biles told Congress in a forceful testimony Wednesday that federal law enforcement and gymnast officials turned a blind eye to USA Gymnastics team Dr. Larry Nassar, sexual abuse of her and hundreds of other women. Biles told the Senate Judiciary Committee that enough is enough, as she had three other U.S. gymnasts spoke in spark emotional terms about the lasting toll Nassar crimes have taken on their lives. In response to FBI Director Christopher Wray, said he was deeply and profoundly sorry for delays in Nassar's prosecution and the pain it caused. The four-time Olympic gold medalist and five-time world champion, widely considered to be the greatest gymnast of all time, said that she can imagine no place that would be less comfortable right now than sitting here in front of you. I blame Larry Nassar, and I also blame an entire system that enabled and perpetrated this abuse, Biles said through tears. In addition to failure of the FBI, she said, USA, Jim. I blame Larry Nassar, and I also blame an entire system that enabled and perpetrated his abuse, Biles said through tears. In addition to failures of the FBI, she said. USA Gymnasts and the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee knew that I was abused by their official team doctor long before I ever made aware of their knowledge. The hearing is part of congressional effort to hold the FBI accountable for multiple missteps in investigating the case, including delays that allowed the now imprisoned Nassar to abuse other young gymnasts, at least 40 girls and women said that they were molested after the FBI had been made aware of the allegations against Nassar in 2015. An internal investigation by the Justice Department released in July said that the FBI made fundamental errors in the probe and did not treat the case with the utmost seriousness. After USA Gymnasts first reported the allegations to the FBI field office in Indianapolis in 2015, the FBI has acknowledged its own conduct was inexcusable. The FBI has acknowledged its own conduct was inexcusable. A supervisory FBI agent who had failed to properly investigate the Nassar case and later lied about it has been fired, Ray said. McClay Maroney, a member of the gold medal winning U.S. Olympic gymnast team in 2012, recounted the senators a night when at age 15 she found the doctor on top of her while she was naked. One of many times she was abused, but she said that when she recalled those memories in a call with the FBI agents crying, there was dead silence. Pope. No place for politics. Aboard the papal plane, Pope Francis said Wednesday that Catholic bishops must minister with compassion and tenderness, not condemnation to politicians who support abortion rights, and warned that Solrics shouldn't let politics enter into questions about receiving communion. Aboard the papal plane, Pope Francis said Wednesday that Catholic bishops must minister with compassion and tenderness, not condemnation to politicians who support abortion rights, and warned that the Solrics shouldn't let politics enter into questions about receiving communion. Francis was asked en route home from Slovakia about the debate in the U.S. church about whether President Joe Biden or other politicians should be denied communion because of their stances on abortion. U.S. bishops have agreed to draft a teaching document that many of them hope will rebuke Catholic politicians, including Biden, for receiving communion despite their support for abortion rights. Francis declined to give a yes or no answer, saying he didn't know the U.S. case well enough. He repeated that abortion was homicide and that Catholic priests couldn't give the eucharist to someone who is not in communion with the church. He cited the case of a Jew or someone who isn't baptized or who has fallen away from the church. Most importantly, he said, was that priests and bishops must respond pastorally and not politically to He cited the case of a Jew or someone who isn't baptized or who has fallen away from the church. Most importantly, he said, was the priest and bishops must respond pastorally and not politically to any problem that comes before them. He said they must use the style of God to accompany the faithful with closeness and compassion and tenderness. And what should pastors do? Be pastors and not go condemning? Francis said. Francis recalled cases when the church had held fast to principle on political grounds and it ended badly. Citing the Inquisition era condemnation of Giordano Bruno for alleged heresy, he was burned at the stake in Rome, Scipione de' Fiori. Whenever the church, in order to defend a principle, didn't do it pastorally, he has taken political sides, Francis said. If a pastor leaves the pastorally of the church, he immediately becomes a politician. Francis said he had never denied communion to anyone, though he said he never knowingly had a abortion. Francis said he had never denied communion to anyone, though he said he never knowingly had a pro-abortion politician before him either. Francis repeated his belief that the Eucharist is not a prize for the perfect, but rather a gift for the presence of Jesus in the church. But he was unequivocal that it cannot be given to anyone who is not in communion with the church, though he declined to say pro-abortion politician was out of communication. Francis repeated his beliefs that the Eucharist is not a prize to the perfect, but rather gifts of the presence of Jesus in the church. But he was unequivocal that it cannot be given to anyone who is not in communion with the church, though he declined to say if a pro-abortion politician was out of communion. You are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for September 20th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Joe Murphy, your host from Drake University. IRIS volunteer. Love to hear from our listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call the toll-free anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. That is 877-404-4747. Gertrude Trudy Claire Russell. On September 10, 2021, Gertrude Claire Russell passed away peacefully in her sleep with her daughter, Heather, by her side. She was 86 years old, a lifelong Iowa native. Trudy was well-loved by all who knew her. Trudy was beloved by her husband of 44 years, Ross J. Russell, and four daughters, Deborah, Ann, Cadel, and Michelle. Heather Marie Russell Schroeder. She was a proud and loving grandmother to her 16 grandchildren, 6 great-grandchildren, and a loving, caring aunt to her many nieces and nephews. Born in November of 1934 to Thomas Monroe and Anna Barbara Adams, Trudy was the fifth of their 7 children and the last of the babies born at home on the family farm outside of Neola, Iowa. She had many fond memories of her childhood and shared wonderful stories of farm life, including countless adventures with her rambunctious yet loving brothers and sisters, Philip J. Adams, Barbara A. Corrin, Mary Jo Dressel, Joseph E. Adams, and Margaret M., and riding their horses, Larry Bird, Ginger, and Chickaquan to their room schoolhouse, the Frog Pond. Trudy went on to St. Joseph Catholic School in Neola, becoming the first person in her family to graduate from high school in 1953. Trudy had a way with numbers, so after graduating, she worked as a teller at First Federal Savings and Loan in the Council Bluffs, Iowa area, later at Council Bluffs Savings Bank, as well as in the accounting department of JCPenney's department store. It was there where she met her future husband, Ross. It took some convincing on his part, but she eventually agreed to a first date, and the rest, as they say, is history. Ross and Trudy were married on January 3, 1964. After their wedding, Trudy began to work alongside her husband, running their family business, the Credit Bureau of the Council Bluffs Incorporated. They worked together until Ross' passing in 2009, when their youngest daughter, Heather, took over for Ross. Trudy continued to balance the books and act as an advisor. She carried with her a lifelong delight in balancing difficult accounts and ledgers, and a particular way of organizing and arranging her currency. In addition to her personal endeavors, Trudy was an active volunteer throughout her life. She was a Girl Scout leader, a room mother, an active member of the Service League in Council Bluffs, Iowa, and a longtime member of St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Neola, Iowa. It was there that she shared her deep faith with others by serving with the RCIA group to assist new members of Catholicism as they joined the church, participating in many Bible studies, traveling internationally with church members, and acting as a Eucharist minister for members of the parish who were no longer able to attend Mass in person. Trudy lived a very full life as a wonderful wife, mother, grandmother, meemaw, sister, professional volunteer, and a woman of faith. She was a very fashionable lady and was hard-pressed to pass up a beautiful jacket when she came upon one while shopping. Even though that section of her closet was more than full, she was a talented cook and baker, following in footsteps of her mother and frequently exchanged receipts with her equally talented sisters and many friends. She loved reading. Among her favorites were The Little House on the Prairies series and the Harry Potter series, and anything by the author Debbie McCombert. She was a consummate hostess who loved to entertain, and a avid gardener with a true green thumb, and an equestrian who especially treasured her horseback rides on the farm with her young grandchildren, as well as her young brother Tom in the mountains of Wyoming. In the early 90s, Ross and Trudy began a home nestled between the two mountain ranges in Saratoga, Wyoming. For many years, they divided their time between the farm in Iowa and their home in Saratoga, building many friendships and spending time with family. Linda Kennedy Wood. Linda Kennedy Wood, age 75, of Council Bluffs, passed away September 14, 2021, at her daughter's home in Harlan, Iowa. Linda was born April 4, 1946, in Omaha, Nebraska, to the late Joseph and Blanche Kennedy. She graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in 1964, and on July 21, 1967, Linda married Jerry Jake. Linda married Jerry Jake Wood in Omaha. Linda worked at Frito-Lay for 15 years, retiring in 2001. In addition to her parents, Linda was preceded in death by her husband, Jake Wood. In 2017, sisters Elaine Kennedy and Karen Rocha, brother Gary Kennedy. Linda is survived by her daughter, Melanie Christopher Carpenter of Harlan, son Brent Tracy Wood of Red Oak, Iowa, grandchildren Jessica, Trevor, Matthew, Allison, Colton, and her grandchildren Maggie, Hudson, Olson, Finley, and baby Denman. Eichhorn, second at Valley. Lewis Central sophomore Ethan Eichhorn continued his dominant season on September 14th at the 47th on Corcoran Cross Country Invite in West Des Moines. After winning his home invite on Saturday, Eichhorn took second on Tuesday with a time of 16 minutes and 48 seconds. Wow. Lewis Central head coach Taylor May said he was proud of how Eichhorn and the rest of the Titans ran. "I thought it was a good night," he said. "Coming up here to Valley is always a tough meet. There's some really, really good competition here in Central Iowa. It was a good day to run, and I thought the kids ran well and responded and took into account the competition and really pushed themselves to be better tonight." Eichhorn won the first high school varsity race of his career on Saturday, is setting high goals for the rest of the season. Marshalltown senior Connor Smith won the race with a time of 16:35. "Obviously, coming off a win, it is good to be in the top two again," May said. He was second here last year. "Also, he's put himself in good position to get that win against, hopefully, sometime soon." Eichhorn's time was 32 seconds faster than the last at the same course. He wasn't the only runner to impress May at the race. "Kay Derricks had a really good race for us today," he said. "Coming up here and finishing in the top 25, that's pretty impressive as a sophomore." "Kid had a really, really good race. He's a good last couple races. He's really on the uptrend and really improving. Logan Fuller and Marshall Arkfield ran good for us too. They pushed and tried to bring that back up towards the front a little bit.
On the girl's side, fresh in my hammock and... Freshman Maya Humlick and Murray Manns led the Titans. Humlick ran a 22:34. Maya and Murray leading us again as freshmen is awesome to see, May said. They just keep pushing and bringing those older girls along with them. I thought they both had really good races today, and Isabel McNeil had another good race for us today. We're continuing to improve. Our girls are on the upturn, and we hope they continue to work towards that. Lewis Central is in action next at 4 p.m. on Tuesday at the Creighton Prep Invite. More in sports, Klopp, Bell tie for first in duel. Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson Boys Golf squared off on Tuesday at Dodge Riverside Golf Course 2 weeks before the Council Bluffs City meet. It was a close match decided by less than four strokes, but the Lynx edged out the Jackets 227-231. Abraham Lincoln Sr., Brody Klopp, and Thomas Jefferson freshman Kendall Bell tied for the first with both golfers shooting a 54. It was a really close match. I think both teams are pretty evenly matched, AL head coach Rob Dittmer said. It was good in the sense that we were missing two of our varsity guys. I thought some of the other guys filled in nicely. Brody Klopp had a really good day. That was his best score of the year so far, 9 holes. Klopp was the only standing out for AL. Jameson has filled into our number one spot, and he played well. Mason Garin's had a really nice day. He shot a 60, which was pretty good for him, I thought. Thomas Jefferson head coach Matt Connor said he was also happy with how his team performed. I think we were trending right. He said, we're starting to see some of the things we're working on the practice coming through when we're playing our meets. We just have to put it together more often. That's the only thing that is. You have to be able to do it consistently. We're working to get there. I was happy with the guys' results. We had some good shots and some bad shots, but mentally, we put them behind them and kept playing. I thought it was pretty good. Connor added he was especially excited about the play of the bell. It's very positive watching him play, Connor said. He's making his way around the golf course, which is great. Every time we've played here, he's gotten one or two, three strokes closer each time. That's great to see. It's the first year playing golf. You can just see the confidence and knowledge coming through each round he plays. Lynx Swimming wins Des Moines North Triangular. The Council Bluffs swim team, powered by the Des Moines North Polar Bears and the Des Moines Hoover Huskies in the North Triangular Swim Meet on Tuesday. With a team score of 104 points, CB shredded the competition by placing first in 8 of the 11 events. Seeing this much success was more than pleasing for Coach Logan Maxwell. We had a fantastic meet with a lot of improvements, Maxwell said. We had a personal best and many of the entries moved some girls around and stepped up when we needed to. North doesn't have the greatest facility we see throughout the year, and I challenge the girls to work through those old blocks, slick walls, and rough waters. They did just that, and credit to the captains, Aurora Miller, Elena Victoria, and the Jocelyn Miller, for getting us there and focused. I'm proud of the progress we've made, and we are all headed in the right direction from the previous years at this point. Junior Claire Curley won the gold in the 200-yard freestyle with a time of 2 minutes and 16 seconds. Junior Jocelyn Miller placed first in the 200-yard individual with a time of 2:39. Junior Elena Victoria took first in the 50-yard freestyle with a time of 26:52. Victoria also won the 100-yard freestyle sophomore. Cameron Moon won the 500-yard freestyle for the Lynx with a time of 6 minutes and 25 seconds. Senior Lillian Ruffer won the 100-yard backstroke with a time of 1:13. Along with all the individual success, the 200-yard freestyle relay team earned its first place as well with a team time of 1:51. Members of that team include Claire Crilly, Aurora Miller, Jocelyn Miller, and Elena Victoria. These four girls were also part of the 400-yard relay team that won first place as well with a time of 4:16. These girls have brought into believing together to prove that we are here to stay, Maxwell said. That mission is critical to keep the center of what we do at every practice and meet, whether we swim Sioux City, Dowling, North, or anyone else. These girls bring it every time, and tonight it showed winning 8 out of 11 events. The Lynx will return
to the water on September 21st in a duel against Sioux City West at Crin Middle School starting at 5:30 p.m. St. Albert's Cross Country wins AHSTW meet. St. Albert Boys Cross Country ran away with a victory at the AHSTW invite on Tuesday in Avoca, with three runners finishing in the top 10 of the meet and six of the top 20. Junior Colin Lilly won the race with a time of 17 minutes and 17 seconds, defending Underwood senior Bryce Pattern by 27 seconds. The St. Albert girls also had a good race, finishing in second place behind Logan Mongolia. Freshman Tyler Teasley led the girls with a time of 21 minutes and 41 seconds and a third place finish. St. Albert's girls are running very well, head coach Russ Zindler said. Carly McCliver ran a great race alongside Tisley. Brendan Smith ran a much improved race, as did Kennedy Sanchez and Mallory Daly. These girls are racing well and displayed that the boys' team is consistently getting better and continuing to run personal best times on all courses. They are very hungry to win. Colin had another individual victory, and Hayden Pizorski ran a greatly improved race. We had a newcomer to the boys' team, Medalo Dang, at 7 feet tall. He is an easy to spot. He ran a great race on his inaugural outing. Our boys' team is truly a tough team. St. Albert is in action next at 9 a.m. on September 25th at Harlan Invite. Saints top Panthers. St. Albert Volleyball swept Creston in Tuesday night's home match using the effective serving to keep the Panthers on their heels. The Saints swept the Panthers in three sets, 25-21, 25-8, and 25-19. Creston always plays us tough and is always aggressive, head coach Edgar Land said. We did some good things on the right on the night and some things we will continue to work on. St. Albert served nine aces as the team had a serve efficiency of 94.6% compared to just 76.1% for Creston. Senior Maddie Hovroth led St. Albert in assists with 11. Sophomore Ella Closeman dished out 8 assists. Senior Lauren Williams paced the Saints with 8 kills, and senior Allison Narami and Mia Allen both drove down 5. Narami also blocked 4 shots, and Williams finished with 12 digs. Junior Landry Miller tallied 11 digs. Closeman served 5 of the team's 9 aces. The victory improved St. Albert's record to 5-6. The Saints are now 7-2 against the Panthers since 2013 and won the last 2 matches. St. Albert is in action next at 7:15 p.m. tonight at the Krumper Catholic. Raiders Edge Lynx. The Sioux City East Black Raiders defeated the Lynx in a 4-set match on Tuesday evening. The Lynx won their first set in a thrilling fashion, 27-25, and what would be the first of 3 sets that would go past 25-point mark. Unfortunately, that was the only time the Lynx topped the Raiders in the set, as Sioux City East would claim the next 3 sets to win the match, 3-1. We didn't play the defense we have been playing earlier, AL coach Katie Darrington said. Sioux City East took advantage of us for that. We played soft and started being safe on offense. We need to learn to finish these games. Senior Bailey Girls led AL with 19 kills. She also accounted for 10 digs and 3 blocks. Junior Reza Green had 11 kills and 7 blocks of the night. Sophomore Molly Romano had 35 assists in the game to go with 14 digs and 3 kills. The Lynx will look to bounce back as the team heads to the Red Oak Tournament on Saturday, which starts at 10 a.m. Ram Volleyball Sweeps Tourney. Class 4A No. 7 Glenwood Volleyball stretched its win streak to 5 on Tuesday in a triangular at Atlantic, sweeping both Atlantic and Clarinda. The Rams are now 15-2 on the season. Glenwood defeated Clarinda 25-13, 25-19, 25-12, and swept Atlantic 25-16, 25-12, and 25-20. Senior Lauren Runfield led the Rams in assists with 53. Senior Burley Arnold finished with 19 kills. Senior Kennedy Jones blocked 4 shots at the net. Freshman Charlie Hernandez and senior Clara Matthews each tallied 31 digs, and Hernandez served 6 aces. Glenwood is in action next week, 7:15 p.m., at home against Chenoa. Boys High School Football. Camrad added the key to slowing down Brook will be playing in position and now allowing easy throws and easy completions. Junior receiver Drew Kingley has 318 yards and 5 touchdowns on 16 catches. The Indians' defense has also been a stout, holding up opponents under 15 points a game in the first 2 weeks. Pella did find some success in week 3, scoring 37 points. Defensively, they give you some fits, Cameron said. They get after the ball and are very aggressive and fly around. Obviously, you don't go 3-0 by not being very good, and they've done a great job of getting their guys in the position and playing well. St. Albert's head coach Jake Driver said his team has to find the desire to make tough tackles if they want to defeat Southwest Valley on Friday. That won't be an easy task. The Southwest Valley senior quarterback Brendan Knapp has rushed for 426 yards and 7 touchdowns on 55 carries. They do a really nice job of doing what they do, Driver said. They run the ball, they play defense, they're fundamentally sound. They're fairly decently sized up front. They have a really nice quarterback that runs the ball and throws the ball well. We just have to hopefully maintain positions and align right and do our responsibilities, and good things will hopefully happen. Driver said the team will specifically have to find a way to shut down Knapp, who has also passed for 71 yards. He's their best playmaker, kind of like us with Brendan being our best playmaker, Driver said. He runs the ball, he throws the ball. They're all designed quarterback sweeps. He does a really nice job of reading the options, things like that. To combat this, Driver said the Falcons will need to align correctly and tackle better. Defensively, the Timberwolves have been running a 4-4 with a fairly standard defense that features man-to-man cover, three schemes. They're really fundamentally sound, Driver said. Their ends to be a nice job of controlling and containing the quarterback and getting pressure. Do a really nice job of disrupting things with their penetration. Their linebackers do a nice job of filling the holes. Driver added that the keys of the game may come on an O-line where the Falcons are starting some of their younger players that had their first taste of varsity last week after some injuries forced some substitutions. It's always tough to go down to Corning and play, Driver said. It's a long road trip. Here's a little more to being the Hawkeyes 10 now with our travel. It's always a raucous environment if you've ever been there. That's a little different for some of our kids. I don't think they'll have been down there. A lot of them haven't played. It's been a fun place. Thomas Jefferson versus Carroll. Thomas Jefferson will be looking for his first victory of the season at home against Denison Schulwig. Denison has always been a team that plays really physical, head coach Brent Anderson said. It's no different this year. They always have some pretty athletic skill players. Denison has two backs over 100 yards in senior Matthew Welts and junior Jackson Haldebrand, and the Monarchs have rushed the 9 touchdowns as a team. They have a big running back that plays pretty hard, Anderson said. They mix around and do a few things with some misdirection. They're kind of a wing T type of offense. Sophomore quarterback Luke Weisenberg has passed at 561 yards and 2 scores, but has also thrown 4 interceptions. Offenses have found some success against Denison, scoring almost 30 points a game. The Monarchs have lost games to Abraham Lincoln and Creston. St. Albert does something similar to what we do against Creston, Anderson said. The last two games, their opponents have done things similar to what we tried to do from offense standpoint. We studied both of the teams and looked at the way they attacked and the ways they had success. In other news, Hispanic Heritage Month underway. Disclosure, Mike Brownlee says is a member of the Central Latino Board of Directors. Central Latino of Iowa and Council Bluffs kicked off Hispanic Heritage Month and celebrated expansion of space and services during the event on Wednesday. We're very thankful to have been here for almost 20 years, Central Latino Executive Director Ramon Calladesda told a crowd of about 50 people who gathered for ribbon cutting to celebrate the center's expansion and take part of an open house. Calzada explained that the Central Latino, located in the Omni Center, offers a variety of programs with a focus of 4 key areas: community outreach and advocacy, leadership training, Latino entrepreneurship, and a cultural competency in integration. The center has doubled its space, adding an open space for hosting a variety of classes, including English, navigating differences classes, while also adding a child care area to help fill a need in the community. The center is also expanding workforce focus. The center has doubled its space, adding an open space for hosting a variety of classes, including English and navigating differences classes, while also adding a child care area to help fill a need in the community. The center is also expanding its workforce focus. Central Latino has partnered with AmeriCorps on projects. Central Latino opened in 2002. Calzada told the crowd when the Latino population in the area was around 2%, it was 11% by 2010. The Calzada said he's awaiting full 2020 numbers for the area. The state Hispanic for Latino population grew to 6.8% from 5% to 2010. We want to show the growth in Latino community. We're still growing, Central Latino
Executive Director Roman Calzada said, "We have a new influx. Our focus is on how we do to get others integrated. We also offer mandate polarizes parents and students." Tuesday's meeting of the Council Bluffs Community School District Board of Education took a turn during a discussion about masks as anti-mask attendees began yelling at board members. Beginning Wednesday, September 15th, all Council Bluffs Community School District students, staff, and visitors will be expected to wear masks at school during the school hours when physical distancing is not possible to help control the spread of the coronavirus. According to a message from Superintendent Vicky Murillo sent to staff and parents Tuesday morning, the move came after a federal judge blocked enforcement of Iowa's ban on school mask mandates. Board President Crystal Farrella told the crowd that the district was a defendant in the federal case in which a judge blocked enforcement of the Iowa law that bars school districts from mandating the use of masks. "After the ruling, we were faced with very real legal liability if we do not use masks," he said. "Why is there no legal liability if we get sick with something else?" asked Brian Hanley, who spoke during the public preparation of the meeting. Hanley noticed that the suicide abuse and drug abuse have all increased substantially during the pandemic. "We're putting our entire population at risk by mandating these things," he said. "Are you prepared to face lawsuits from the other side?" asked Adam DeBell. That drew a loud round of applause from the many in the boardroom. "This is a temporary restraining order," Amy Foster said. "The law still stands. You are choosing to muzzle our children. You are forcing children to be responsible for other people's health and safety." One father said he had heard students who refused to wear a mask would be taken to the office of their parents called to pick them up. "I will be pulling up to the office and taking my child out for ice cream," he said. That also drew applause. Melissa Tucker also spoke during public participation. "I hear you are legally bound to mask your children," she said. Trucker said young boys like her son hear different frequencies than girls and that he has trouble hearing his teacher when he is speaking through a mask. In other news, district receives offer on Madison campus. The Council Bluffs Community School District has received an offer on Madison campus property, officials announced during a hearing on the property possible sale held Tuesday by the Board of Education. The board plans to vote on whether to accept that offer. During its September 28th meeting, the Madison campus building, formerly a Target store, was purchased by the school district for $1.9 million in 2018. Used as a temporary school facility during a renovation of Kern and Williamson middle schools and $4.4 million remodeled the facility and was paid for by the funds of $37 million bond issue approved by voters on September 11, 2018. Kern students attended class at the Madison campus during the 2019-2020 school year and Wilson students had school there during the 2020-2021 school year. The 95,335 square foot property is currently listed by Heartland Properties at $3.9 million. John Jurofich, a partner at Heartland, said that the Menards project planned for the site of the former mall of the Bluffs has been delayed drastically. When the new Menards store is built, it will likely bring lots of traffic, including truck and semi traffic, that might limit the number of other potential buyers and might not make it a good place for the school, Jeroka said. "I think you're going to see a very busy site on there," he said. "I really see the building getting a different type of use," Jorgo said. "And prospective buyer was complete. I think you're going to see a very busy site out there," he said. "I really see the building getting a different type of use." Jorgo said the prospective buyer was a company that would put it on a tax rolls and create jobs. He declined to reveal the offer or the identity of the business. "The company has been in Omaha since 1979, said Jason James. His partner at Heartland Properties is currently employs about 500 people and sells products throughout the lower 48 states. And that brings us to the end of today's reading at the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for the September. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for September 20th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from our listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris programs, please call the toll-free number anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. That's 877-404-4747. I'm Joffrey Murphy from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Volcanic eruptions can affect global warming or cooling, and one of the ways we measure their impact is by looking at a lunar eclipse. To understand this strange connection, we need to know a bit about Earth's atmosphere. The lowest part, the troposphere, extends from the surface up 4 to 12 miles. It's where Earth's weather happens. The stratosphere, above that, is dry and less active. Dust and ash particles carried into the troposphere by volcanoes, fires, or other sources will quickly fall or be rained out. But when a large volcano erupts, it blasts ash and gas through the troposphere into the stratosphere. There, sulfur gas forms microscopic droplets of sulfuric acid. These sulfate aerosols can remain suspended for years. One way scientists measure them is by looking at lunar eclipses. If they're murky and dim, the stratosphere is clouded with aerosols. If they're bright and defined, the stratosphere is clear. Large volcanoes in the past have put up enough aerosols to reflect the sun's heat and cool the surface of Earth by as much as 1 degree Fahrenheit. But in the last two decades, the stratosphere has been remarkably clear, which has allowed more solar energy to reach Earth. Some scientists estimate this has caused half the global temperature increase seen during this period. Another example of how Earth's processes are linked in surprising and complex ways. I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.